Science 30. Is it possible to gauge distance visually in a space rendezvous? This is one of the questions the American astronauts Walter Shearer and Frank Borman discussed with Peter Reed in Wellington last night. Captain Shearer and Colonel Borman commanded the Gemini 6 and 7 spacecraft during the historic space rendezvous on December the 15th last year. After that rendezvous, Colonel Borman and James Lovell went on in Gemini 7 to complete 14 days in space, travelling over 500,000 miles. Now Peter Reed puts his first question.
Captain Shearer, how did you first become an astronaut? Was it an early ambition, or did circumstances dictate this?
I'd say it's more like circumstances. I had no awareness when I first was asked to join the organization now referred to as NASA, or National Aeronautics and Space Administration. There was no set policy for putting men into space. In fact, I guess I was one of the first to know that this intent was even forthcoming. I was busily engaged in testing new aircraft as an active test pilot. When brought to Washington, D.C. for an interview, a half an hour interview, and then asked, would you like to go into space? I was looking for the no door.
How about you, Colonel Bowman?
Well, I was in the second group of astronauts into the program, and I applied after a rather calculated effort to qualify, to achieve the qualifications that were required. So I, of course, came after Wally 2 or 3 years, and I was looking forward to it.
Gentlemen, may I ask you collectively, we have for many years been treated to a series of science fiction films, and in those films there was always the blast-off sequence of the then astronauts of the future, and we always saw these characters with their faces stretched out like rubber bands, grunting in agony against the G's pressure. What is the truth behind all this? Do you suffer complete discomfort at time of liftoff, or are you able to move?
Well, Wally and you just used the correct term. Wally and I try to correct everyone when they use the term blast-off. We like liftoff rather than blast off. But actually, it's a very smooth, almost imperceptible motion as you take off or lift off. Then as you do proceed through the launch phase, the thrust of the rocket remains the same, and of course the weight gets smaller because of the fuel is being used. And you do pick up accelerations in this manner, eyeballs in, and it does get a little difficult to breathe at two stages of the launch, but it's certainly nothing really exciting or anything that that approaches the horrendous things I've seen also in science fiction.
I see. Captain Shearer, on December the 12th, what is the term abort, isn't it? The misfire took place.
That's correct.
And you were left for an hour in the rocket until the pressures fell. At this time, it would have meant that if the if you had have escaped, shall I say, mm-hmm. that this would have put the flight back considerably.
Well, in fact, it would have destroyed the mission as far as Gemini 6 was concerned. Mm. We had a false indication of liftoff. This, in turn, through the circuits which protect our total mission, shut the engines down prematurely. They were burning for roughly a second and a half, and then they started shutting down due to this false signal of liftoff. They normally burn about 3.5 seconds before we lift off, which was about the only cue I had left after many other cues that I had lifted off. And that I did not eject, and that was my prerogative then, of course, to either eject or not. We did not, and this would have ejected both of us. This would have destroyed the spacecraft for a flight. It would have taken many months to repair the damage from the rocket that fires the ejection seat out.
What actually could have happened in this case, if at the worst?
Well, once I had made up my mind that we had not lifted off, and this is all in a brief period of about a second and a half, knowing positively I had not lifted off, I was safe as I was in the spacecraft. But if I had lifted off, then the booster would have settled back on the pad, and there would have been a rather calamitous explosion. And that's why we have the ejection seats, to get clear of this massive explosion that will fire us out of the fireball.
So I think Wally probably won't add, but this is the most critical part of the entire launch, the first 10 seconds. And if we'd have just been an unreasoning person, he would have ejected, because the cues were there. I mean, if we'd have had an automatic system, this would have required the loss of the mission, but he didn't, and he used it.
I see. So your chances of survival in the case of anything happening later are pretty good, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I think possibly the best compliment I heard about this decision was that the best computer made by man is that between his ears.
True. Captain Shearer, you were up in Sigma 7, wasn't it?
Yes, that was the Mercury flight.
Did you encounter any shall I say, pangs of loneliness at that time? Did you experience anything like that when you were alone in space?
In the Mercury flight?
In the Mercury flight.
No, we had almost continual communications, radio communications, and we were quite busy. Typically, many people wonder, did you have a break-off phenomenon, or did you feel that you were way out there alone in space in this dark environment? And we like to kid about it and say, well, we plan to cry a lot. But that's not really the case. We're booked up. We have experiments to perform. We have systems to check in the spacecraft. And we try to put in a little bit more in the mission than we can achieve, just so that we don't have any boring moments. And I'll have to admit, it's never been boring on any phase of any mission, including, I'm sure, in Frank's case, 2 weeks of flight.
Yes. Yeah, so your flight, Colonel Bourne, would be equivalent to a moon trip, wouldn't it, in time?
Well, actually, it would be equivalent to the longest moon trip that we've projected to date. The nominal one will be around 8 days.
Oh. Now, in your flight, you had some 20 experiments to perform, I understand.
That's correct.
Including stellar navigation.
Well, we were evaluating a sextant. I wouldn't say it was stellar navigation as such, but we were trying to determine the usefulness of this instrument for future applications.
And I understand also you were determining position by timing occultations behind the limb of the Earth.
Again, we were using...
You must be one of the first men that has actually seen Earth occultations. Was there much dimming to the star?
Well, yes, the star. You see that the problem that you have is there's an air glow layer. And so you have two or three different horizons.
Mm.
And it's difficult to... the scientists are trying to determine exactly the proper distance above the Earth, the actual horizon of these air glow layers.
Yes.
Consequently, we were trying to determine for them the height of the air glow layers by timing the star's occultation as it went through the various layers.
Mm. What equipment did you use for that?
Well, we had a very sensitive light meter on board, and then we also used the sextant.
I see.
We both ended up, I think you'll find that almost all of our flights, we are continually making observations. Frank had a very much more heavily programmed study of celestial phenomena. We, in turn, were using almost the identical piece of equipment, the sextant, to measure angles between their spacecraft, both with artificial light and reflected light, measuring angles subtended between their spacecraft and a known star. We were using the star Sirius. And this was to, we hope, develop a technique possibly for using angular measurements for rendezvous supplement information.
Are the stars visible in daytime?
Not enough to be cataloged as you can see a star in daytime. We're very interested in that in the rendezvous mission. And we'd like to use the star background to maintain a constant line of sight as we affect the final phase of the rendezvous.
Mm.
I could see stars about 4 minutes prior to sunset and about 4 minutes after sunrise. But that is all.
Mm.
And we made a specific test for this, and even the bright planets were not visible during daylight.
In the case of the rendezvous, how about visually gauging distance? Did you find that possible?
We couldn't see apparent size of Gemini 7, and it was 10 feet in diameter, until we got to about, I'd say, 3,000 to 3,500 feet. Up until that point, it was basically a point source. We initially acquired them by reflected sunlight, and this is the way we mapped our trajectory for the rendezvous, at about 48 miles. And we maintained this visual acquisition to about 30 miles, and this was then our local sunset.
I see.
And we lost sight of them until we picked up their artificial light, which was a bright light, a beam of light, man-made, of course, at about 23 miles. And, of course, we followed this through the night period until about 4,500 feet, where we again acquired them with sunlight, reflected sunlight.
Mm. In the case of a lunar landing, I read recently somewhere of the possibility of monitoring the sun with a string of observatories around the Earth in the case of solar flares.
That's right.
In the case of a flare on the sun, would your space vehicles be able to stop radiation, any of the dangerous...
It's one of the design criteria for Apollo, and the reason we're very anxious to have these flares predicted is so that we can take protective cover.
Mm.
We wouldn't be wearing or utilizing this protection except in the event of a solar flare, and then we, of course, would retreat to safety or else put on a garment that would provide the protection.
I see.
And again, depending on the magnitude of the flare and the prediction time we may have to hurry back home.
Yes.
This would be a tremendous dose, as you can imagine.
How long do you think the present techniques will last? For instance, would the... Gemini or Apollo, say, be able to do not only a lunar trip, but possibly a planetary trip? Or would there be further breakthroughs?
I don't think either one of those would make it to a planet. No, we have to, first of all, we need a new propulsion system, or at least a better propulsion system, and then, of course, we're going to need a more life support capability than we have in either of those vehicles.
Thank you, Gail Borman.
The American astronauts Walter Schirra and Frank Borman were talking to Peter Reed in Wellington. Science Savvy is broadcast each Tuesday evening after the 9 o'clock news. The time is 9:20.